Welcome to another edition of Svarim Chatter Live / Svarim Chatter Podcast. For this show, I'm going to be joined by Professor Eve Kurkowski, who is the Assistant Professor of Near Eastern Studies and the Program in Judaic Studies at Princeton University, as well as the author of Coming of Age in Medieval Egypt, Female Adolescence, Jewish Law and Ordinary Culture, also Princeton University Press. Okay, we'll get going now. Okay, we have you on. Thank you very much for joining me. I just forgot to mention that we'll obviously be discussing the Cairo Geniza. So why don't we start off with giving a brief background about yourself?
Okay. Can you hear me?
You can.
Excellent. Okay. So as I believe you probably just said, I'm an assistant professor at Princeton University in the Near Eastern Studies Department and also in the program in Judaic Studies. I received my PhD in NELC, which is a very similar program to Near Eastern Studies. It's Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations at the University of Chicago in 2012. And it took me a long time, actually, to finish my PhD because I had a number of children while I was in my coursework, also while I was writing my dissertation, and I should say also since I finished the PhD as well, which I'm mentioning just in case you have any listeners who are in the same boat to let you know that this is doable, although I also had a lot of help and along the way. I'm a social historian of the medieval Near East, mostly focusing on Egypt and Syria. So I work on the social history of the period, focusing on Jews, but I also work on the history of Judaism in the same time and place. And most of my work is based or centered around documents preserved in the Cairo Geniza, which is what I'm going to talk about with you today.
Okay, so I think we should jump right in and just give everyone an overview. What is the Cairo Geniza? People probably have heard of that. They may not know what it is exactly.
Yes. Okay. So the Geniza is an enormous collection of medieval writings, mostly written by Jews, although not all written by Jews, which survived for reasons that actually we don't fully understand inside a synagogue in Fustat in Egypt. So Fustat at that time was a sister city to Cairo. Nowadays, it's been absorbed into Cairo itself. Most of this material comes from the 10th to the mid 13th centuries, and mostly, as you might expect, from Egypt and also from Greater Syria, although there's material that's actually very widely diffused across a greater range. But the core material is from Egypt and Syria. Since this time and place is probably unfamiliar to many of your listeners, I'm going to step back, and before I even talk about the Geniza, give a little, like, undergraduate 101 lecture in 5 minutes just on this time period, and then I'll come back to the Geniza itself. So the Jewish history leading up to and surrounding this period that I'm guessing many listeners of this podcast are probably familiar with goes, you know, in stages from Chazal to the Gaonim to the Rishonim. So we're sort of in between the Gaonim and the Rishonim here. But that way of telling the story glosses over some really important large-scale human changes that happened in the world in general and to Jews in particular between these stages, which you really need to understand in order to understand who the Gaonim or the Rishonim were and what they were doing. And in fact, this history is one of the things that the Geniza lets us see in much finer detail. So I want to just set the stage by going back in time to a period that's probably much more familiar to the listeners. To late antiquity, so roughly second to early 7th centuries, the period of Chazal. So this is when the Mishnah and Gemara take place. And at this time, as you probably know, the Middle East was under the rule of two major empires, the Romans in the west and the Sasanians or Persians in the east. And this division is very easy to remember because the Mishnah and then the Yerushalmi were produced under Roman rule in Roman Palestine, mainly in the north of present-day Israel, whereas the Bavli is produced in present-day Iraq under Sasanian or Persian rule. But then there's a huge, huge change that occurred in the 7th century with the birth of Islam and the Arab-Islamic conquests of the Middle East. And for the first time, this whole region, what we now call the Near East or Middle East, which had not been a single region in the same way up until then, was now united politically under a single empire, and it remained that way for about three centuries, between the 7th and the 10th centuries, which is the period right before what the Geniza documents. And it's a period of enormous, enormous transformations in this region. There's a whole cascade of changes that happen. Travel and trade across the entire region increased. There was large-scale urbanization, so people moving into cities. And as a result of both of these things, among other factors, there were also massive religious, linguistic, and intellectual shifts. So there was wide-scale conversion to Islam across the region. there was Arabization. Everyone started speaking Arabic as their everyday spoken language, really the only major exception being Persian and Iran. And there was an explosion of new kinds of religious, scientific, philosophical, and literary writings in Arabic, but also in other languages. Now, the reason all of this matters is that all of these changes are happening to Jews as well. So this history matters profoundly for Jewish history, because first of all, the vast majority of the Jews in the world lived in the Islamic Middle East at this time. Many, many more. We don't have exact numbers, but clearly many, many more than lived in Europe. So this is really where most of the world's Jewish population is, and they're experiencing these changes, and they're also participating in them. They're traveling, they're trading, they're moving into the cities, they're speaking Arabic, and they're developing new kinds of writings. So by the 10th century, at the end of this huge period of change under the early Islamic Empire, Jews were now living in a very different, more urban, more interconnected, more cosmopolitan world than they had been during the times of Chazal. And this includes the Gaonim themselves, who this period is, you know, named for in kind of traditional historiography. They were based in Baghdad, the capital of this empire, from the late 9th century on. Okay, and that takes me to my final point before I go to the Geniza itself. And this is actually especially important for the listeners of this podcast. This time and place, the early Islamic Middle East, is when the foundations of rabbinic writing that underlie all of rabbinic scholarly culture first developed. So Sfarim Chatter begins actually here. Our first evidence for the Bavli being written down and circulated and consumed in a written form comes from this period. This is also when most of the major genres of rabbinic writing that follow after the Gemara first started to be used. So commentaries on the Mishnah and the Gemara, as well as on Chumash, legal monographs that are like systematically organized around a particular legal topic, responsa, Shailu Suchuvos, all of these are first developed likely in the 9th and 10th century, along with other genres that were very popular at the time but are not so much anymore, like works of systematic grammar and theology. All of this does not appear among Jews by accident or in a vacuum. These were all genres that were typical of the intellectual scholarly text cultures of the time. So you have the versions of the same genres developing among Muslims and Christians, as well as among Jews, although not in the same languages. Okay, so all of that was background. Most of these changes are happening before the Geniza material begins, before we have any Geniza documents or manuscripts, but we know about its effects on Jews largely through the Geniza. So where does the Geniza itself take place? In the mid-10th century, the unified Abbasid Empire, this vast unified Islamic empire that I've been talking about, politically broke apart. And it gave way to several smaller successor empires that were still very culturally close to the Abbasid model. So they're not politically unified anymore, but they all take major cultural elements from the former empire. And the most powerful of these empires is the Fatimids, the Fatimid Empire in Egypt, which you'll remember is where the Geniza was housed, where the synagogue was. And this is where the first layer of the Geniza comes from. Okay, so the Geniza was a small room in probably what was the largest synagogue in Fustat near Cairo. And this room contained maybe around 330,000 pieces of paper, actually some are on parchment, that seemed to have been placed there by people using the synagogue from the 1020s steadily on all the way to the 19th century. Although most of the material is medieval, so it mostly comes from the Fatimid and the Ayyubid periods from about 969 to 1250. So it's widely assumed, and I'm sure everybody listening assumes as well, that this material was put in as shamos because of the taboo against, you know, discarding or throwing away material with Hashem's name or maybe even in Hebrew script, you know, culturally, even if not strictly necessary. In a casual manner. The truth is we don't know for sure. We don't actually know that that's why the material was put there. There's no Geniza manuscript or document that says that. And a lot of the material is not shamos, is not religious, is not in Hebrew at all. Moreover, we know that there's a practice of placing discarded manuscripts and papers aside in kind of like structures or inside of a wall or inside of a jar in a wall. They've been discovered elsewhere in the Middle East, especially in Egypt, not only among Jews, but among other groups as well, going back to late antiquity, although there's nothing nearly on the scale of the Geniza in this region. It's unique in its size, but the practice is not unheard of elsewhere. Okay, so what is this stuff? About 90% of the Geniza is literary material, by which I don't mean novels, but anything that was written down, you know, for an audience to read sort of over time. We call literary material. Most of it is Jewish religious writings. Actually, the largest bulk of the material is piyut. There are many, many fragments of biblical codices, so books of Chumash and Tanakh. There's bits of Midrash, bits of Gemara, bits of Yerushalmi, and so on. A lot of fragments of rabbinic literature, and then a tremendous amount of medieval Jewish works in all the genres that I just mentioned. Commentaries, theology, scientific works, medical works, translations of Tanakh into Arabic, and so on. And there's also actually a minor genre, but important, book lists. So overall, it gives you a snapshot of the Jewish intellectual and scholarly world of the time. Importantly, an important point is that most of these works are not preserved as full codices, as entire books, but they're fragments. So an individual page or two, or small groups of maybe 2 to 4 pages. The majority of the writing, not the piyut, but most of the medieval writings are in Judeo-Arabic, which is Arabic written in Hebrew letters, roughly analogous to Yiddish, that's German in Hebrew letters, although Judeo-Arabic is much closer to the general spoken vernacular of the time. There's also works in Hebrew and Aramaic, and also in other languages. And part of the fun of the Geniza is that there's always delightful surprises, like really weird things that you don't understand how they ended up in there. But Judeo-Arabic, Hebrew, and Aramaic is the bulk of it. Okay, so that's the literary Geniza. Now, the last 10% are documents, by which I mean not a work that was written for a, you know, undefined large audience into the future, but everyday writing written by one person or a group of people to another. And this includes things like personal and business letters, also communal letters written like for local political reasons, legal documents, mostly Jewish legal documents, although there's a small number of Islamic legal documents, and actually there's also Islamic State documents that ended up in the Geniza that have been the subject of an important recent study, which I'll get to later, shopping lists, packing lists, doodles, and so on. These are the documents. This is what I work on. In my eyes, this is the most precious part of the entire collection.
Right. Okay. So I think that was really, really well put down, obviously. So before we move on to get down what specifically was found there, more examples and then your work, how was this discovered and I guess disseminated or put into libraries? What would tell the listeners what happened there?
Sure. Okay. So this is actually a story that is only being fully understood now. And if you had asked me this a year ago, I would have told you something else. So the classic story that I would have told you and that is well known and lovely and true, but it's just not the complete truth, is that there were these two Scottish women, sisters, Agnes Lewis and Margaret Gibson, who lived in Cambridge in England, not the one in Massachusetts, who were scholars of Semitic languages and of Greek, and they were also manuscript collectors. And in the 1890s, they traveled to Egypt, where, among other things, they acquired a piece of Hebrew writing. They didn't know what it was. They brought it back home with them to England, and they showed it to Solomon Schechter, who is a very famous person in his own right. But among other things, he works at Cambridge at the time. He looked at it and realized that it was a fragment of the lost Hebrew version of Ben Sira, ancient piece of Hebrew writing from the Second Temple period, which had survived only in Greek. Again, this is all the kind of classic story. He saw this, he was wowed, he jumped on a ship, went to Egypt, found the Geniza, arranged with the local community to go in and take everything out. Okay, the real story, I mean, obviously, even classically, the real story is more complicated because all the material didn't end up in Cambridge, it ended up elsewhere as well. But the real story that is now emerging, largely thanks to the work of a scholar named Rebecca Jefferson, who's at the University of Florida, she's been doing a tremendous amount of work understanding what actually happened better. And I believe she's coming out with a book, which is not out yet, but she's published a number of articles, which are already incredibly illuminating. And what she's pointed out is that the medieval synagogue that had been standing in Fustat since the 11th century was actually largely demolished in the 1880s. The roof had caved in. The community decided that it needed to be renovated. And during the renovation, this chamber with all of this material in it which had been concealed under debris, was opened up and manuscripts started being taken out in a process that we don't really understand and sold, which is how Bensira ended up on the market for the sisters to find it in the first place. What seems to have happened is that all the material or much of it was at some point taken out, and then once the synagogue was rebuilt, returned. This all matters, and I'm going into detail because what she argues, and I think it's convincing, is that much of the Geniza was probably damaged in the process, and it's very possible that originally there were full codices in there, and that the reason we now have fragments is because of this process that happened in the late 19th century. Okay, so how did it end up in libraries from there is during this process, word started spreading around. Different dealers and collectors came. It wasn't just Schechter. There were a whole kind of very colorful cast of characters who came and removed material. And I'm saying removed because there are different accounts at different times of how this worked. Sometimes it seems that things were purchased. Other times things were simply removed with permission of the heads of the community at that time. And actually, some texts were unearthed, it seems, from a cemetery near the synagogue and didn't come from the Geniza at all. There are fragments that ended up classed with Geniza documents that were purchased from dealers without a clear provenance. We don't know where they came from. So it's very possible to look at a Geniza fragment if you're used to this world and see who the people who appeared in it are in the Middle Ages. But whether it actually passed through the Geniza or through some other mechanism is not always 100% clear. And actually tracking this and understanding it better is something that's happening now in scholarship. Final thing I'll mention on this point is that there was probably a much less known, enormous collection of full codices, full books, in a different synagogue, in the Karaite synagogue, which ended up in St. Petersburg. And that's a very different collection. It's got somewhat of a different intellectual profile, but it's just as important in a lot of ways. Well, not to me, because it doesn't have as many documents, but it's extremely important, and it's much less accessible than the Geniza at this point in time.
Right. So like you mentioned, Solomon Schechter at that point was in Cambridge. So that's where most of it ended up. But a lot of it, I think Elkanathan Adler's part ended up in JTS and Oxford. Yes, you want to talk about the other large collections where they are?
So there's dozens of different Geniza collections in the world. The major ones are, as you say, at Cambridge, at Oxford, at JTS, and was briefly on loan to Princeton for the last few years, which was very exciting. There's a small but important collection at the University of Pennsylvania. There are European collections as well. So there's many, many collections. Those are the main ones.
Right. And St. Petersburg was because of Firkovich. How did it end up there?
That's the Firkovich collection. That's a whole different story, which is somewhat contested, but maybe for another time.
Okay. So that's that. So I guess you already explained, I guess, what a Geniza, the fragments are. So I guess how do people actually use them, you know, so to speak, because it's just small pieces in different libraries. Did like one piece rip and end up in different libraries, one in Oxford and one in GTS? Like, how does that, maybe I guess this segues into talking about, I mean, not being clear, kind of the Friedberg Project, where that is, maybe discuss the practical uses today.
Sure. So, okay. So in order to understand, so let me backtrack and just briefly mention what I do, and then I'll explain the process that I use when I'm researching. So I, as I said, work with the documents, and I mostly do social history. So for me, there is still no comprehensive catalog of the Geniza. This is a goal that all the scholars in the field at this point share, but there really isn't a comprehensive catalog with unified standards across the catalog that every Geniza, you know, fragment has been identified and described, much less, you know, transcribed with the letters typed out neatly and translated in the same way. That does not exist yet. So a lot of what you have to do Geniza research at this stage is go back through the history of scholarship and look at what people have said so far and track down through the works that have been written already and track down through a number of databases that now exist, the documents that matter to you. So let me just explain what the history of scholarship looks like. So in documentary Geniza research, which is my field, there's really one towering scholar who founded this field and recognized it as relevant. His name is S.D. Goitein, and he worked through between the 1950s and 1980 and built a 1985 and built a comprehensive foundation for studying historically this material, which was published in a 5-volume work called The Mediterranean Society. So usually when I want to start working on anything, I first go and I look there. I see what he said. I start building a database from his work. Then I go through scholars after him and do the same thing, comb through footnotes, comb through all the published documents that there are. And then I start looking at the electronic databases. So let me tell you about the electronic databases. The major one is the Friedberg Geniza Project. Anyone can access it. It's jewishmanuscripts.org. It's a completely revolutionary tool for scholars in the field. You can go on, if you know the shelf mark, the library number of any document that you want to use, you just put it in, and over 90% of the time, there's a high-resolution image available there that you can look at. They've also aggregated all the bibliographic references in scholarship to that document. So you can go, you can look at what Goitein and his students and people in 1902 may have happened to say about this document. And they've aggregated a lot of the library, the holding library's own data on the documents. So you can go through and sort of find out everything you want to know about this document. This is revolutionary in a lot of ways. First of all, for me, I started out the conversation saying that I was doing my dissertation work with kids. I could not have done that without Friedberg. And I actually didn't realize that when I started my dissertation. I was very lucky that this tool actually existed, because really to do any kind of serious work, I would have had to be flying to Cambridge and be traveling to different libraries to look at these documents myself, or simply relying on what had been published already. But now I could sit in my pajamas on my couch and look at the documents. So that's revolutionary in and of itself, is just accessibility. But working with the physical documents, which used to be an incredibly difficult, costly, and limited experience, and now anybody can do it, it has transformed the way scholars are relating to the documents as material objects. And the last thing that it's doing is making it much easier to join fragments. So it's not just that we only have single pages. A lot of them are torn, and you'll have half, you know, half a page in one library in Cambridge, half a page is in JTS. The Friedberg Project has a join finder, which is very fun because anybody can do this. You can just put in a fragment and you notice that half of it seems to be missing. You can ask the join finder to find matches, and they'll find you 100 options. I will honestly say I have yet to find a join through the join finder, but I have colleagues who have done so, and very often what it helps you do is find documents that look similar. So you may not end up with an actual join, but you may suddenly, one of a graduate student in my department just last week discovered a whole new genre of document, literally by using this, because she was able to see that they're all laid out on the page in exactly the same way with the same like constellation of words at the top. So I use the Friedberg Project extensively, but as is probably becoming clear, a lot of the process is detective work. You know, I start with a set of historical questions. I go in, I try to figure out what's there. I get bogged down in very, very boring questions that become really interesting the more you're working on them. And I'm trying to tell my family at the Shabbos table how exciting it is that I've figured out what this formula means, and their eyes are glazing over. And then eventually, you know, all of this work coalesces into a new and better set of questions informed by what's actually there. And I get to actually writing.
So I wanted to mention that, first of all, there is an app, at least on Android, a Friedberg. You can use it as an app. You can download it.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
And I also wanted to mention, maybe talk a little bit about the whole Friedberg Project, which is pretty amazing what he did, Mr. Friedberg from Toronto, which is that it's like been millions of dollars, like you said, and it's pretty recent that it's been finished, right?
Yeah, it's I don't exactly remember. Well, it's quote unquote finished. I mean, in, the work is never finished, but I think the Friedberg the JewishManuscripts.org website has a number of components. The Geniza Project is one. There's also a database of, I believe, the entire Bavli with variants from every manuscript that they know of in the world. So that's a different thing. And there's also this is less known, but there's a library of Judeo-Arabic texts, which is keyword searchable on there. So yeah, there's a huge array of things. For Geniza specifically, there is an app and it's great. But I also should mention two other websites that are Geniza specific that do other things. So Cambridge has its own Geniza website, CUDL, Cuddle. So you just if you Google Cuddle Geniza, you'll find it. And what's great about that is that it's just a lot easier to use in some ways than Friedberg. And there are high resolution images that are downloadable, as well as sometimes fuller descriptions of the documents. And then at Princeton, the Princeton Geniza Project, which I'm involved with, which is directed by my colleague, Professor Marina Rusto, that website's specialty is the documents. And there are full text transcriptions of several thousand documents on the website, which means if you're doing work in the documents itself, any word that you come across and you suspect maybe this has like a technical meaning or a kind of social meaning that I'm not really grasping, you can put the word in, find other documents that use it, and quickly build up a completely different picture of what your material is saying.
Wow. So I should mention that the other one, the Bavli variant is called, I believe. There's an app as well. I've used it many times. It's phenomenal with all the different Gersias of the Talmud Bavli.
Yes.
That's a different part. So I want to jump back a second. I forgot to ask you. So how did you get interested in Geniza, though, when you were starting out? What attracted you to that?
Okay. So I started out in my doctoral program thinking I wanted to work on medieval biblical exegesis, on Mefarshim. University of Chicago is a very old-fashioned place. We spent a lot of time in my graduate program. Well, it's not an old-fashioned place across the board. My program was conducted in a very old-fashioned philological way. We spent a tremendous amount of time studying texts very, very closely, and it was all intellectual history. So all, we did Chuvos, but other than that, it was all Jewish philosophy, Jewish exegesis, poetry. And I increasingly was feeling like I was just missing the human life behind the material I was studying. I was also taking history courses. And then I was doing all of this Jewish philology, and there was no human beings in what I was doing. And then I took a class on the Geniza documents, and I just completely fell in love. The Geniza documents are really, they offer us the most intimate, richest, most detailed look that we can get at real people's lives, probably anywhere in the pre-modern world. This is not just in the history of Judaism or in the history of Egypt. It's a unique, unique source. And I discovered it after already having started to train in Judeo-Arabic and focusing on this period. And I just felt incredibly lucky that my graduate training had prepared me to do work on this corpus. And I switched over and have not looked back. I would like, instead of just talking about how great it is, to give listeners a little bit of a sense for it, precisely because, and I'm talking about the documents here specifically, because they were not written for posterity, they were written for immediate use, they bring us into people's lives in an immediate close-up way that we're missing when we just look at literary works, into people's households, families, everyday ways of understanding the world. And I sent you before our talk two documents, images and translations. They're not my translations, they're Goytein's translations, which I think you posted to Twitter, right?
I did, yes.
Okay, so any listeners who are able, while listening, to switch over to Twitter and find this tweet, which I think was, I'm not on Twitter, so, but it's appended.
It responds to the original tweet. I mean, they could come back. I promise it won't be lost at
the same time. But yeah, it is on there. So
okay, fine. So these are two documents I picked more or less at random. There's nothing special about them except one of them is very short, and I knew we wouldn't have a lot of time for this. And the other one is just one of my favorites. These were both identified by Goytein, this founding father in the 50s and on, who really established the field of social history. And he had a knack for just finding the really, the human stories in the Geniza. So the first one, if you look, is just a little scrap of paper. Let's count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines. In his translation, which is a slightly fanciful, but it's more or less captures the meaning. It says, "This is to inform you, my lord, the elder, may God make your honored possession permanent." So all Geniza letters start with various kinds of honorific formularies at the beginning. That Abul Hassan, which we have to assume is the son of the person this letter is addressed to, after his transfer to my school, showed great zeal for study. So this is a letter that seems to be written by a teacher to the father of one of his students. His great misfortune was that Abul Hassan ben Wahib, this is a different boy with the same name, broke his board, meaning the board on which they were presumably doing writing exercises, with the knowledge of the other boys. Vishalom, you can see at the end. Okay, this is nothing special. This is just a scrap of paper. It just gives you a sense for the human detail that you get from these documents. The next one is actually quite late for the Geniza. This is 14th century. So as I said, there is later material in the Geniza, and people who specialize on that later material will not appreciate my saying this, but most of the material is earlier. Most of what I work on is earlier. This is a 14th century document. I just love it. And you asked me, you know, why I chose to study this, and I switched from kind of straight religious intellectual history to this more human history, and this document is a great example of it. So I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm going to walk you through it. Okay, so it begins with these same kinds of honorific formularies. In your name, you merciful, to the high seat of our Lord, the Nagid, blah, blah, blah. This is addressed to the leader of the Jewish community at the time, who is a descendant of Maimonides, a descendant of the Rambam. It's actually narrated by a woman who calls herself the slave, or in Goethe's translation, the maidservant, which is just a way of speaking. This is how people wrote when they were writing a letter to somebody socially above them. They called themselves a slave. That in and of itself is incredibly historically important and interesting, but not going to go into it now. She kisses the ground, also very standard formulary, which has its own history, and submits that she has on her neck, meaning she's responsible for 3 children, because her husband was completely infatuated with life on the mountain with Al-Qurani, in vain and to no purpose, a place where there is no Torah, no prayer, and no mention of God's name and truth. So Goitein figured out what this is. This is a known Sufi mystic, a Muslim Sufi mystic who is identifiable at the time. This completely unknown anonymous woman is writing to the head of the Jewish community to complain that her husband is going and hanging out with these Sufis and leaving his children alone. She talks about how hungry they are, how they have no food. And if you just skip to the bottom of this first column of the translation, the only thing which the maidservant wants is that her husband should stop going up the mountain and show mercy towards the little ones. If he wishes to devote himself to God, he may do so in the synagogue, attending regularly morning, afternoon, and evening prayers and listening to the words of the Torah, but he should not occupy himself with useless things. So you have a little bit of popular theology here. I love this letter because you really hear the voice of this argument against this husband. Of course, we don't know if this was really the woman's own voice or the voice of the scribe, but even so, it gives you a sense for what an ordinary Jew, not somebody who would ever make their way into a more sophisticated literary work, what their idea of Judaism is in this period. Okay, so to answer your question, working with documents like this is what drew me into this field and has kept me there.
Yeah, really, really fascinating. So it's up on the Twitter if anyone wants to see it, and it'll be there after as well. So let me ask you a little bit about your book that you wrote, which is called, I mentioned in the open, but I'll say again, Coming of Age in Medieval Egypt, Female Adolescence, Jewish Law, and Ordinary Culture, which is Princeton University Press. It is available as a paperback. It's quite affordable, especially so when it was on a sale when I posted it, 50% off sale recently. But why don't you talk a bit about what it's about?
Okay, so the book is about young women, and it follows young women from basically puberty to marriage, which is not necessarily a very long stretch of time. That's one of the things I was trying to answer. But what the book is trying to do is understand women's lives and some of the institutions that shaped women's lives at the beginning of the life course by focusing on this very small bit of time. The book looks at things like at what age did women marry? What kind of economic arrangements were women involved in? So dowry transfers, women's labor before marriage and in marriage choices, women's mobility, ideas of modesty, and sort of personal relationships in the household, but not in the sense of, you know, individual personalities necessarily, but what are the ideas about relationship that are structuring young women's lives? So that's the focus. And through it, the book is making two major arguments, okay, which I'll try to summarize very briefly. One is that the popular idea that people have tended to have about the family in the medieval Middle East in this time and place is of kind of big patriarchal clans. So you have, you know, the patriarch, the grandfather, and all of his children and grandchildren living with him in a big house, and everything is controlled by the men in the family, and it's kind of this clan structure. So that's a simplification, but that's the overwhelming stereotype. And even Goitein's work somewhat pushed that idea. He talked about how cousin marriage was very common and that the family was patriarchal. And yet, if you read his work, it's very clear, even from reading his work, before I did any of my work, that this doesn't make a lot of sense because people are getting divorced all over the place. People are remarrying all over the place. So one of the major arguments of the book through looking at things like, you know, how often is a young woman getting married, you know, with a living father even, and how common is remarriage? And then looking at the actual stories of people who show up in these letters and legal documents. One of my arguments is that the family was not organized in this patriarchal way according to kind of a set clan structure, but was instead very fluid, and that the ideas that people had about family ties were very much at the individual level between relatives. And I make an argument about how this parallels ideas of political patronage and economic patronage in the same time and place. So that's the first idea about the family. And the colorful way of putting this is that odds are, looking at the way these families were organized, that your average child in Fustat in the 11th century as likely as not did not grow up in a single household with the same relatives their whole childhood. Okay, so that's argument number one. And then argument number two is about Jewish law. And the argument there is really simple. This was a legally conservative society to the extent that we can tell, to the extent that we look at legal documents produced by the Jewish courts, produced by the Beis Din. They are following rabbinic law in a very conservative manner at the level of technical practice. And yet when you look at the way people understand their lives and structure their lives, it's totally different. And the kind of case study for this in the book is how the Bogeres, the mature adolescent girl who technically in rabbinic law is in control of herself after puberty, how she's treated as a legal person and how she's treated as a human being. Legally, she is actually given that maturity, and yet that has no social meaning. And what really seems to happen, I argue, is that women achieve some kind of independence and social adulthood at marriage. And even if they don't marry, which is very, very vanishingly rare in this material, the few cases I have of women who stay unmarried, they're not able to acquire personal property, they're at the mercy of their relatives, they're never able to achieve social adulthood.
Wow. Okay. Fascinating. So obviously people can check it out in the book. So I want to address a question here, overarching question that I often get asked people that do know of the Geniza. I mean, people mention is that, you know, the classic line basically is something that you kind of referenced in the beginning. The Geniza maybe was Seamus. So it was Seamus. It deserved, it belonged to be there. It was put there for Seamus. It's not important. So something like that.
Okay. So you mentioned this to me before we spoke, and I put more thought into this question than anything else in the interview, because the other questions I'm used to answering, and this I was a little befuddled how to answer. So the first thing I'll say, actually, is this is not a trivial question from a historian's point of view, actually. Not necessarily in the way that the people who have said this to you mean, but there's a real problem for historians of patterns of survival. So especially, no, actually with anything, when you're dealing with material that was received down through the ages or through found material like the Geniza, how did we end up with what we have? How representative of it is it of, first of all, what was actually produced at the time? And beyond that, how does what was produced at the time reflect reality? These are all major, major questions. And with the Geniza, which is an accidental, you know, anti-archive, I think Goitein called it, it's a real problem. So, for example, right now I'm working on legal documents in the 10th century. I'm trying to understand how and why people are recording Jewish legal documents in this period, even though they're also using Islamic courts, and it's not clear what benefit it gets you to have a Jewish legal document. So this is something I'm working on right now. I have a group of documents. They're all written a certain way. It's very distinctive. It's different from what happens in the 11th century. So I have a real problem. Is that because that's what's being produced in this period and that's it? Or is it that for some reason this group of documents made it into the Geniza? And actually there are reasons I could guess. Like some of them you can see the people, scribes later on, scratched out the words and wrote new names above it. So what does that show you? That a later scribe was using this as a model and was copying from it and inserting different names. So maybe what I have are the especially beautiful documents that were saved to use as a model and then later shoved into the Geniza. Maybe there was a whole other legal practice I'm missing. So these are really important questions that more and more historians in this field are becoming attuned to. Historians in all fields are attuned to them. And it's a real question. That said, obviously, you know, from my perspective, that doesn't mean not to use this material because it's what we have, and it's so much better than anything else we have. So the solution is to be attentive to it and to try to think through the problems and be honest about the problems. And I try in my writing always to be very honest about the limitations of these sources. I'm guessing that is not what you meant, though.
What do you mean? No, well, I did kind of mean that. I mean, I guess it ties into the other question I was going to ask you, similar, which is, what practical use can the Kinesa be to us?
So what I thought you meant was from a religious perspective. So
right, which I do mean that as well. Yeah.
Okay. So I'll answer. I put thought into this. So I'll answer it first, and then I'll tell you the practical. They're not really practical, but they're of great human use, I think. So as far as should a from person find Geniza material and read it and take it seriously as part of Judaism? I can't answer this question for anybody. And as a matter of fact, I mean, I don't, that's not the approach I take, because I'm approaching it from an academic perspective. And I try hard to separate conceptually the two worlds. So there is an idea that you don't paskin or take direction from material that was lost and that didn't come down to us through a line of Masorah. That's a completely logically coherent idea, and I'm not going to judge it or address it one way or the other. If you are comfortable reading anything that was lost and then recovered, if you would learn the Meiri, if you would learn from manuscripts from Yemen, the Geniza, there's no reason to think the Geniza is any different. And I don't think this sentiment that it was, garbage and therefore not worth learning makes any sense at all. So for all the limitations of what we know of how representative this stuff is, I really think we can say with confidence that what ended up in the Geniza was a kind of cross-section of the Judaism of its day, the people of the time, viewed many of these works, especially the ones where we know who the author is, as in exactly the same mold as other works that have come down to us. You may have heard of the Rambam. He lived in Egypt. I mean, the truth is he didn't think much of the Egyptian Jews that he led, but he did live there, and his own works, his own handwriting ended up in the Geniza. And so the idea that this material was somehow other or different from some other Judaism that was happening at the time is just not, that makes no sense historically at all.
Right. I was going to say with these type of things, it could just be also it was Seamus, but not in a way that it was garbage, just that, the Sefer got ripped or the scroll got ripped, so they put it there or something like that. Not that actually it was bad. Also, I wanted to just mention the Meiri. You mentioned, obviously, famous, the Chofetz Chaim and Mishneh Berurah used Meiri to paskin. I think the Chazon Ish was the other side, if I remember correctly. But the Chofetz Chaim famously did use Meiri. So halachically.
In terms of halachic material, okay, so you asked me pragmatically, so we can jump to that. What do you mean by pragmatic?
What do you mean?
You asked me what pragmatic use is.
No, practical use, really, practical. I mean. Yeah, practical use, meaning, is it just like historical or obviously, like, I don't know, I guess, like svarim, there are like halachic svarim and there are things that are actually useful.
Okay, so
I don't mean to, I'm not mean, sorry, that came across as harsh. No, let that go. Not meaning to belittle your work. I don't mean it that way.
I am not even remotely offended.
But I didn't mean it like that.
No. I completely, completely understand. I wasn't sure which part of it you meant as pragmatic versus something else. Okay, so it is of immense, immense historical importance. And I'll start there. I think I said this, but it is the richest or among the richest sources for social history, for the history of actual people's daily lives that survives from any population, almost anywhere in the pre-modern world. And this is because it's not just a very, very large collection of material, but it's very dense. So precisely because we have documents of all kinds of different genres, as well as all of these literary manuscripts, which were produced often by the same people. So we have documents and, fragments of sermons and other manuscripts in the same handwriting that you could see across. You're able to see these people's lives from an enormous range of angles. So it opens up a huge range of topics in the history of this population. And so some of the things that have been studied from it include, so there's a lot of work on communal organizations. So a tremendous amount of the documents are actually about like petty fights over communal leadership of institutions. And there's been a tremendous amount of work reconstructing who fought with whom in the autumn of 1094. It's very familiar if you're used to Shul politics. I personally find the details of this stuff extremely tedious to work through because I'm not that interested in Shul politics now, and it actually was not that much more interesting in 1094. But you have to understand it to understand a lot of other things. So there is actually a lot of work that goes into things people would not have imagined that 1,000 years later we would be like pouring over the fight that they had because one of them insulted the other one and he went up to the Aron. But in fact, there's a lot of that stuff. But beyond that, there's a huge amount that you can understand about everyday life and about political and economic life. And because no source like this exists for other people, you can use it for the general social history of the period, although you have to be careful to understand what is specific to Jews and what maybe is reflecting broader trends. But so everything from material culture, so food, how people dressed, what horses they rode on, what perfume they thought was nice, commerce, how trade was organized, how economic life was organized, how people related to and experienced the state, the Islamic government, people's family relationships, which is what my book was largely on, and people's everyday ideas and experiences of morality, of how to be polite, of what's rude, of what it means, you know, how you die, of what your dreams mean. As my colleague Jessica Goldberg has put it, an almost unimaginable treasure trove for historians. Some of this work has been done. Some of it is still waiting to happen. So that's the documents. In terms of the literary Geniza, what is the pragmatic use? Okay, we would know vastly less about how Judaism developed in this extremely important period without the Geniza. And the little talk I gave at the beginning about the missing links between late antiquity, the world of Chazal, and the Middle Ages, the Geniza fills in this enormous gap in what was actually an incredibly, incredibly important period in Jewish history. And we would know, our knowledge of it was vastly impoverished before the Geniza was developed and would still be without it. In terms of, you know, individual writing, oh, one last thing I'll say. Okay, so I recently published a paper on a well-known event in the life of the Rambam, when he passed a takana in Fustat in Egypt, ordering women to use the mikveh properly or else they would lose the marriage payment that their husbands owed them. So we knew about this through, we knew about it in a Hebrew We knew about it through the Geniza and also I believe through a European manuscript. It's embarrassing because it's my paper and I can't remember. We knew about this separately. It was in a European manuscript, and then we also know about it through the Geniza. But using the documents and combining them with sources from the literary Geniza, I was able to reconstruct, I think convincingly, a lot more about what the actual practice that he was responding to, about how he tried to go about it. So what was his legal reasoning in passing this takana, and what actually happened when he passed it, which actually was not what he expected. what I found is that what happened at first is that all sorts of divorce cases were filed using this as an excuse by men who themselves were not probably all that invested in the issue. But then long term, over time, Maimonides' vision did prevail. And it seems that 3 centuries later, people still remembered this takana and practice had changed dramatically. So this is an example of you take something in the history of halacha that you know about as this kind of little story, and you're able to see the actual human reality of it in much greater detail. I'm mentioning this because I happen to just write this, but there are all sorts of subjects and studies like this that you can do.
Right, so I kind of meant this. The question just wasn't really meant to be there. Like I said, it was just meant to lead you kind of to this. And another thing that I would mention as well that I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, is that Solomon Schechter used this to prove that Ben Sira originally was written in Hebrew as well, not in the Greek.
Correct. And that was a subject of immense debate when if you go look at the old back issues of the JQR, there's just article after article after article addressing different aspects of this point. And you can see them kind of figuring out through this debate what exactly this material is and how it works. But you also wanted to know about Svarim and about intellectual history and figures we wouldn't know about without the Geniza, yes?
Right, and I'll just keep talking. I'm going to jump off screen. I have two here. Actually, they were just printed from using the Geniza. Okay, go ahead.
Sure. Okay, so first of all, Gaonic history is a huge, huge field that is not at all entirely reliant on the Geniza, but tremendously, tremendously enriched by the Geniza. So there are many, many responsa and legal monographs of the Gaonim that have been reconstituted and published from the Geniza. That's one major, major area. Another major area, which I'm going to cheerfully plead mostly ignorance because it's not my world at all, but it's the world of Piyut. So people who are into Piyut, you know, the entire field is Geniza dependent, and it's its own very, very rich internal field. I don't work on it at all, but actually, I think I heard somebody recently estimate that 40% of the Geniza is Piyut, often with other stuff on the back. So I usually care about the stuff that's on the other side, but that's its own giant world of scholarship. Okay, so the study of the Masora, so there's many, many fragments, vocalized fragments of Tanakh, that's also its own other world. And then in rabbinics, so, you know, the study of Medrash and of various other ancient rabbinic works, finding fragments of Geniza and variants and understanding how they relate to the versions that we have is its own thriving subfield. There are other medieval works, so the major kind of authors who are most represented and most well-known are the Gaonim and then the Rambam and his son. Although there's also, I mean, there's other fragments, there's riff fragments, there's all sorts of other stuff, but basically, you know, medieval authors who are in the orbit of this world, and a lot of the Rambam's material, mysticism of different kinds, yes, but not, okay. And then Rambam's son, Avram ben Rambam, whose work is known as well through this corpus and his life.
Right, which a friend of mine, actually, Moshe Maimon, did a podcast with him. He published, he used some of the Geniza fragments on the, he just put up Horatius and the Maimer on the Agarata as well. I wanted to mention two that came out of here. One was called Tur of Versadigain, Sefer Amidus, which they have a list of all the fragments. There's many more pages than this. This is Haitzer, that's the company's name. And there's another one called Halivu Begalus on Esther that they also published. I believe this one was published maybe in English by somebody partially on through Brill, but those two were basically reconstructed mainly through the Geniza, two from Sadigan that were lost, I believe.
Yes, and those are, there are many other such works that have been, that have been published. Yes.
Right, okay, so I was going to ask you, like, who are some famous people that stuff that we found there? Obviously, you mentioned the Rambam and his son, and what's interesting is, I guess, you can point out to people, is that we have their actual handwriting, meaning a lot of people don't realize certain, a lot of manuscripts of Rishonim are not their handwriting, it's just copied.
Correct. We have their handwriting. And for both of them, we have not just, we have the whole spectrum. We have their personal writings. We have communal writings, responses that they issued to people in the community at the time, letters that they wrote both about personal affairs, but even more so about communal affairs, and were able to put together their lives in context. If your listeners are interested, I saw somebody pop up, ask a question about mysticism. So there's a book by Alicia Russ Fishbane that is on Avram ben Rambam, and he was actually sort of a Jewish Sufi in a way, a mystic who borrowed from Sufi teachings, and that has been
All right. Well, here's the new one. And my friend did here. He put the his actual handwriting on the front.
Beautiful.
See here. So yeah, I think I wanted to mention also that we have actually, I believe there are some fragments of the Rambam's own handwriting of Mer Nevuchim. Is that true?
I honestly, I don't know. It's very possible.
I thought so. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
The earlier fragment that I mentioned, the one that I looked at, and I'm reading a question off the screen here. No, that was later, but.
Gotcha. Okay, what about some famous documents? I believe there was like sheet music found in the Geniza. Is that?
Okay, so there is there's a very famous convert to Judaism from Europe, Ovadia Hager, and there are some musical compositions of his that were found, and I'm just trying to find, okay, there's a website devoted to it for people who are interested. They're by Gary Rendsburg at Rutgers University, johannes-obadia.org. So that's johannes-obadiah.org. Yeah, that's very famous. The Ben Sira fragments obviously are extremely famous. What else is famous? Ah, okay. You had Professor Schiffman on to talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Correct.
Okay. Fragments of the Damascus document, which is one of the, you know, quote unquote sectarian writings found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, were first discovered in the Geniza shows you there was some kind of continuous manuscript transmission of this work from the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls up until the Middle Ages. And that caused a sensation when it was found. And just like there was fighting over the language of Zanzibar, there was all sorts of back and forth about whether this was a medieval work, whether it was really an ancient work, whether it was a forgery, what was it. So that is one of the more spectacular finds that hasn't yet been fully understood. There is fragments of a work or maybe even just a genre of writing called the Masim, which are Palestinian, late Roman Palestinian legal writings that are otherwise completely unknown and seem to reflect a different legal tradition from the Gaonim and from everything that follows after them. Incredibly, incredibly interesting. Published recently, a publication of many of them was put out by a scholar named Hillel Newman. And then there's also, you know, moving out of the sphere of Jewish history, there's actually Fatimid state documents. So documents put out by the Fatimid state that ended up in the Geniza because once they were not being used anymore, they were cut up, sold as scrap paper, and people bought them and did things like write piyut on the back or write down the notes for a sermon they were going to give. And a scholarly work that just came out very recently is reconstructing the entire workings of this medieval Islamic state from the Geniza. That's Professor Marina Resto's The Lost Archive. So this is which some is a of Princeton. The range of what's there. Yeah, also a Princeton University test.
Right. So I was going to ask, what are some books that are written using Geniza documents or fragments similar to your book that you would be suggested reading that are to get to know the Geniza, so to speak, a little bit more in the time period?
Okay, so I would suggest that people start with Goytein. This is the 5-volume work, A Mediterranean Society. It's old. Other things have been written since then, but it's pretty much everybody's in the field, scholars in the field, it's the first thing you fall in love with most of the time. And it's because he really just, it's this unbelievably rich panorama of the corpus and of all the different subjects that it touches on. And it's just packed with incredibly interesting human stories. Do not read the 1-volume abridgment. That takes all of his arguments, which are the least important and interesting part, and it removes all the interesting detail, which is the important part. So go to the 5 volumes and pick the one that interests you the most. There's a volume on the family. There's a volume on material life. So, you know, how people fumigated their homes and what roads looked like. There's a volume on the community, on the economy, et cetera. So this is a wonderful place to start. Works that have been written since then. Okay, so I think I already mentioned Marina Resto's The Lost Archive. That's not so much Jewish history as history of the state and Islamic history, but it's a phenomenal book. Her earlier book would, for some of your listeners, maybe come closer to home. It's called Heresy and the Politics of Community. And it's on social and political relationships between the Rabbinites, rabbinic Jews, and the Karaites, who I have not talked about at all, but I could say something about if you would like. Or not. So the Karaites were basically the one major group of non-rabbinic Jews that exist in this time period. They're very much a product of the same intellectual literary revolution that I talked about at the beginning of our conversation. And they basically rejected Chazal. They rejected rabbinic tradition as having any kind of divine or revealed authority, although they sometimes read rabbinic writings and found them interesting. But they were, you know, the very, very simplified way of saying this is that they were like, you know, the Protestants are to the Catholics. So they believed in studying Tanakh directly and extracting laws from it. What actually happens is that, as in any community, they ended up developing laws and a system of their own. This book, Politics and the Heresy of Community, is looking at how these two groups actually related to each other in real time and showing that they were much closer in everyday life than you would think if you just read the polemics that they were writing against each other. Okay, so that's one book. Another book that I highly recommend for listeners, because it's very human, it's very accessible, and it's very interesting, is Mark Cohn wrote 2 volumes on poverty and charity in this community. One is The Analysis, and the other one is Translated Documents, which are just really wonderful to read. It's called The Voice of the Poor in Medieval Egypt. A phenomenal, phenomenal book on the economy, on commerce, by Jessica Goldberg, called Trade and Institutions in the Medieval Mediterranean. There's also a recent book on partnership contracts. There have been really wonderful work done on marriage contracts. And as I mentioned, Alicia Rush Fishbane's book on Avram Ben Arambam and his mystical inclinations and the controversies he was involved in. A book that recently came out by somebody called Elizabeth Lamborn, which is the entire book is on one packing list. And I think it's called Abraham's Luggage. And it's on an India trader, a Jewish trader from Egypt who was trading in India and what the packing list shows you about his life there. There are works that are going to be coming out soon on marriage disputes, on slavery, on conversion, and on other topics. But if you're just kind of interested in getting a feel, start with Goitein.
Gotcha. Now, I want to ask you, is it affordable, though? I know sometimes these books are like, the prices are crazy.
I have them all on PDF. Feel free, anybody who is listening to this, to email me. I will send it to you.
Okay, so they can then your email can be found on Princeton University's website, right?
Yep. Yes.
Okay.
Should also mention a huge, huge service to humanity and to the field by a scholar named Menachem Butler. He recently created an academia.edu page with all of Goitein's articles, which are in the hundreds. The two little snippets I showed to give you a flavor of the Geniza come from these articles, and they're basically the building blocks of a Mediterranean society, but with the full documents. So where the work just has, you know, descriptions and snippets, these have translations and transcriptions, and there are just unbelievable gems scattered throughout these articles. So you can go look up SD Goitein's academia.edu page.
Yeah, I know Menachem is not listening at my Stender. Obviously, everybody knows him from Twitter. So Menachem is great. We know I think he mentioned that he put those up. Now, how about some books I've been reading out of the history of the Geniza? Obviously, you mentioned that's kind of been like changed a little. So the book that I read with a little difference, kind of more the popular history. But if someone wants to just find out, read about the history of the Geniza, what would you recommend?
I would recommend Sacred Trash by Peter Cole and Adina Hoffman. It does include some of the same history that I was talking about that Rebecca Jefferson has uncovered, although she has since gone farther. It's really a fun read. It's very, very readable. And each chapter tells a different face of the Geniza, so to speak. So different components of what's in this corpus are focused on in different chapters. And it's a very fun book. I believe it's pretty inexpensive as well.
Okay, gotcha. So just to end off, I would say, what is it? What are you working on currently? You're working on a new book. What are you working on currently?
Okay, so I gave myself away a little bit at the beginning of the talk when I was going on about this big textual transformation. I'm working on the 10th century. I'm trying to understand how it is the case that... So one thing I probably did not emphasize as much as I could have is that the Geniza kind of tears open a veil onto a world that it's not just that we don't have a lot of other material surrounding it, but it comes after many, many centuries where we have no actual manuscripts at all. So no actual physical manuscripts produced for many, many centuries before the beginning of the Geniza. And even the works that we have that were, meaning they're dated to this period, but they were copied later, they're very historically hard to understand. They're not written in a way that you can really grasp when or where they were written or who wrote them. And then all of a sudden, there's this, you know, veil that lifts and you have this world in incredibly vibrant living color. I mean, one of the things that's remarkable about it is that among rabbinic Jews, at least, there's a very like coherent shared textual culture that has already developed in the 10th century, which, you know, is really the foundation of medieval rabbinic Judaism. So I'm working on a book trying to understand that transformation from a number of different angles. And right now I'm working on legal documents, 10th century legal documents, which use a very set formulary, meaning the legal words, you know, the technical phrases are quite stable across different documents. And I'm trying to understand where this formulary came from. And it's really, really cool because you can compare these documents to other non-Jewish and Jewish material from all the way back to ancient Aramaic, and you can kind of peel back layers of history that must have existed in this ongoing scribal tradition that we don't have. We have the endpoint in the 10th century, not before.
Gotcha. Okay, looking forward, and really, really fascinating. Thank you very much for coming on. I hope people maybe know a little bit more about the Karo Geniza now.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Thank you. Take care.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.